Can I just ask how, I mean, this just doesn't come into play now, right? I mean, we don't worry about it now because that isn't the way the current tax system works at all, but you kind of, I mean, and I'm trying to remember the history of going back with
through the chair. Actually, I think a very good analogy would be what happens now. As you're probably aware, under the Merchant Marine Act, ships that ply between two American ports have to go through the United States and crew in the United States. Let me leave aside the various issues of whether that's good policy for defense or for labor issues. Estimates, if you look at similar foreign flagged vessels, they cost about one-third. So one of the things that's happening is our the value at the wellhead is being decreased because of higher costs, because there's this sort of local content issue. And when we look at costs, one of the things that arises is, I mean, I remember a very specific issue about a system had to be torn out of a ship because it had been purchased abroad and they went over there some domestic content level and a new expensive American system had to be put in, and the question was, ought that to have been deductible or not? So those kind of questions do impact. We do look at them, and generally I don't think those kind of tests are really pertinent to what folks are trying to accomplish here with this bill.
I have more questions about it. It just concerns me, and I think maybe there's some way to work with it. Thanks.
For the record, Representative Kelly and Representative Stoltz have joined us. Go ahead, Ralph.
Yes, moving then on, down on the same page, lines 26 through 28. This is a section of the bill that lists the items that are not deductible. And item or subparagraph B previously said royalty payments. There were questions raised about royalty equivalents. And so this language has been expanded then to encompass those royalty equivalents. Going on then, the next major change is on page 26.
Chief, you can back up, sir. Thank you, sir. I appreciate the expansion of the does not include B, but if I could take us back up to under the does include subparagraph B, where direct costs include payments of property taxes, sales and use taxes, motor fuel taxes, and excise taxes. We've discussed previously the in lieu issue. Could you address that?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, we have, and we think, I mean, the recommendation of the administration would be we would strongly support an amendment which would allow payments in lieu of tax as well as the taxes listed. Again, they're an actual cost. They may be higher than taxes, they may be lower than taxes, but they are judgments made by the folks involved that that's an appropriate set of payments to make, and we think it, again, represents the cost of doing business here in the state.
Thank you. I definitely would endorse that provision myself. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, actually, let's stop at page 23 for a moment before we go on past that. And I would just like to draw your attention to a couple of items, lines 16 through 18. This is language from the Senate bill. And this language specifically addresses transactions that may not be an arm's length transaction. And what it says is that amounts in excess of fair market value are not a deduction for transactions that is an internal transfer or otherwise not an arm's length transaction. There was concern about intercompany transfers. The basic thing is that we do not believe that amounts in excess of fair market value would ever be allowed because they're not ordinary and necessary. It was felt, though, as the bill progressed along, that it needed stronger language to be more clear about amounts in excess of fair market value, and so this language was in the Senate version and has been brought in here.
And moving down to the next,
the very next subparagraph, and that would be lines 19 through 22. This is language to make clear that if a business is purchased, that the purchaser does not just get a credit for purchasing all those as assets. That was never the intent under the bill, but this language has been added to clarify that, and it's language from the Senate bill. On line 23.
Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm wondering if on the exclusion in end, we've got a rather broad exclusion here. You know, two issues. First off, I believe the language as written would very clearly exclude any, essentially, you know, purchase of intangible asset, that be, you know, goodwill or blue sky in a transaction. But what, just a what if you've got someone working, you know, a producer, explorer, very active, and they, you know, go and, I don't know where we go, they go to Texas and buy a company because that company owns a drill rig that they want to come bring to Alaska and deploy. Are they precluded from deducting the cost of that company they bought to bring that drill rig to Alaska? Which would effectively prolong the cost of bringing that, having that drill rig on site?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, it would appear that that would, you know, yes, it would appear that way. The checkbox there typically would be, as you know, you can treat certain purchases of corporations as an actual purchase just of the assets and not of the corporation itself for federal tax purposes. This language appears to say that that election would be the fact that you're purchasing stock in a corporation instead of the assets that might represent the value behind that stock would disallow it.
Okay. If I might continue, sir.
Representative,
we both know the difference. You know, obviously, if the same company sold us the drill rig and we brought it up here, it would be deductible. But the fact that, you know, as you know, drill rigs are often built, operated, owned in joint venture arrangements, and you know, so the way you would acquire the rig is to buy out the joint venture and bring. And I'm using that as a hypothetical, but bring the specifically because there is a single asset or a list of assets that you wish to bring to Alaska and deploy. I mean, I guess this raises a question in my mind of an unintentional exclusion.
Representative Walker, through the chair, I think what folks may have been focusing on more was the situation we had here several years ago, of course, when you had a major corporation being purchased by another one, which obviously huge assets like, you know, whatever it was, 42% ownership of Trudeau Bay was among the assets that changed hands. As you say, that there are assets that do change hands by way of these kinds of transactions.
Right, and I certainly would not want to allow rolling purchases where they take turns owning it every year, so everybody gets a deduction every year for the same asset.
Representative Walker, through the chart, I might point out that I believe that is specifically disallowed elsewhere, where you don't, well, actually the deduction would, but the credit portion would not because it can't have been placed in service previously in the state.
Okay, well, obviously I want to go on, but I'd sure like the chance to come back and think about this one. And on the same page, if we're getting ready to go on, if I may roll back up the page to a question.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Line 3, this is where we're, you know, excluding costs from fraud, willful misconduct, which is all very good things to exclude. We get into the issue of negligence. Negligence versus ordinary negligence versus gross negligence becomes an issue in my mind. To exclude simple negligence would seem that, again, you know, I've got a guy working on top of a ladder with a 5-gallon bucket of white paint, and, you know, it wasn't very smart of him to take the 5-gallon bucket of white paint to the top of the ladder. He should have put it in a smaller container, take it to the top of the ladder. He knocks over his 5-gallon bucket, it falls on a control module. And, I mean, we just spent $150,000 on a spilled bucket of white paint. This would seem to disallow that cost. Well, in fact, we try to have safety. You know, we do make an effort to incent safety, responsible operations. You know, such accidents of negligence are ordinary and expected in the course of the conduct of business. But I'm just wondering, you know, what is the potential disallowance here? We're creating a margin that is so far down the scale of negligence, when in fact we really want to be setting a line on a bar up here that says we don't want to pay for acts of gross negligence, you know, basically oil spills. We don't want to pay for oil spills.
Representative Walker, through the chair, I think putting in something like gross negligence would indeed seem to line up more with the fraud and the willful misconduct standards, that it takes sort of an assertive, active bad behavior
opposed to merely being something that was ignored or a reasonable man standard, or I'm getting out of my head, not as an attorney. But I think what you've raised is a fair observation that, that inserting the words gross there might make that the ideas expressed in F more coherent.
And if I might continue on that vein, sir, and then I would also, if that change were to be made, I would suggest, would we not want to be looking at that, that some, what is the past the gross negligence standard, would we not want to put in, and I'm thinking of the catastrophic oil spill standards that were established in the House Resource, that's a policy call, but the House Resource standards for substantial or catastrophic oil spill to make certain that simple, you know, I don't know what you call it, simple negligence, but you know, you're just not paying attention to that piece of pipe and you just dumped an untold amount of oil into the environment. I'm not sure I want the state to be party to cleaning that up either. So, do you have any thoughts on the catastrophic oil spill language that was in the House Resources version?
To the Chair, Representative Hawker, the language that was in the House Resources version talked about catastrophic oil spill and had to do also with inland or marine waters. I think it was language taken directly from, pertinent marine spill language. If that language were to be pulled in, our suggestion would be to clean it up a little bit regarding the water, depending on what the intent of the committee is. But if
no pun intended about cleaning up the water.
if the intent is to address spills on land as well as in marine or inland waters, then that language would have to be adjusted a little bit. I would also note that catastrophic does have a statutory definition within statute, and it refers to 100,000 barrels, which is about half of what the Exxon Valdez was. So it is a lot of oil. By contrast, the oil spill up at GC2 is about 6,000 barrels. So it would go a long way before it would hit the trigger of catastrophic oil spill. So those are just a couple of thoughts on the language that was in the other version.
I submit that we ought to consider this language, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Yeah, not to belabor it, but if we are going to consider it, I mean, the problem is, and maybe Mr. Mintz can respond to this, I mean, negligence has such a broad range. I mean, even before you hit gross negligence, and I'm frankly not remembering exactly where that switch is. I mean, to be grossly negligent, you suddenly pop up into a whole another realm of really bad behavior. But even, quote, simple negligence can still be pretty profound. I don't know. Do you want to talk about it now, or should we bring it back up?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Couture, I could just say a couple of things. I mean, as you know, negligence is generally equated with conduct that's not reasonable, and so that can cover a lot of territory. Gross negligence is quite a high standard, and it's not right lot next door to negligence. It's quite a ways down the block. But this is just off the top of my head. It strikes me when I listen to Representative Hawker's concerns that they perhaps they're in part related to the magnitude of the consequences due to the negligent conduct, and that maybe we could look at a standard that, for example, would not exclude relatively minor or routine costs resulting from negligence, but something more major, perhaps use of the term like a disaster resulting from negligence or a major cost resulting from negligence. Again, that's just something off the top of my head.
As us wordsmiths are looking for words, that becomes problematic in its own, but I would agree with your conclusion.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yeah, thanks. I'm sorry. I was trying to come up with the not reasonable, and I wasn't remembering it. Thank you.
Okay, moving on then. I would note on line 23, and we're still on page 23, subparagraph O makes clear that the progressivity tax is not deductible for purposes of the PPT. That's where that language is found. Then subparagraph P, those are lines 24 through actually it goes on to the next page, a number of lines. This is the language that disallows costs incurred for abandonment of facilities on, quote, old production. And so this subparagraph provides a ratio calculation of the production both before and after the effective date, which will accomplish then any new facilities that are put up after the effective date, those would be deductible. But to the extent that the facilities made production before the effective date, then those costs would be pared down proportionally. And this language came from the Senate version, but it has been clarified a little bit, but the intent and the result has not changed. Okay, moving.
Mm-hmm. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Robin, do we know where we fit in a world view of this same situation? Have you looked at how other taxing authorities, other owner versus operator, producer contracts handle this? Have we got an idea that whether what we've got here is normal or abnormal, or everybody does it or nobody does it, or what?
Representative Kelly, through the chair, I think the classic answer will be some people do it, but what I'm going to distinguish is I think when folks are looking at costs and these costs would be allowed, what's more normal in world fiscal systems will be, you know, there'll be a slug of cost oil or something that will be sort of predetermined as to how much. When they look at and figure out how much that is in that negotiation, they would probably look at things like abandonment cost. But typically, if you're looking at, if you're trying to get to what somebody spent, the cost of winding up a business or winding up a particular segment of it are just as real as the cost of conducting it. And just because they come at the end doesn't mean they weren't a necessary, ordinary part of it.
So you're saying this is more in the normal, more common range, the way we've done it, not just the hilltop concept. This is
Representative Kelly through the chair. I actually don't know. I mean, what's happened here, and maybe I misunderstood your first question. I actually am not familiar with any place else that creates a ratio. So you would look at a platform that was abandoned in Cook Inlet last year and say that's not deductible. The platform next to it, because it had 2 years of extra production, gets to deduct, 10% of its abandonment. So that particular feature, I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I can do a little research, go ask some folks, but I'm not aware of that particular feature anyplace else.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, then on to page 26.
On 24, sir.
No. Thank you.
44, this year.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the indulgence. Subsection E here, which is a lengthy section, but essentially it's saying that for under determining what your deductible expenses are, if you receive a credit or payment back on one of those, you don't get to deduct it. So it must be subtracted from the amount you intend to deduct. These are subtractions from the deduction. Looks pretty thorough in good words, but actually on this one, in a conversation with the gentleman across the table here, I'm not sure that it's absolutely explicit in here that an insurance recovery would need to be added back. And I'm wondering if we ought to have language in here that would very explicitly make an insurance recovery one of the add-backs.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, we believe it's clear here. We'd be happy to work with people about if more clear language is desired.
Thank you.
And Representative Hawker, through the chair, if I might. I mean, again, if you go back to earlier and how this section is structured under 160, what typically we would be looking at is typical industry practice. And so, I fully believe if in the Prudhoe Bay unit there was some insurance and there was recovery by the Prudhoe Bay unit, the majority owners would make very sure that the operator didn't just get it and didn't keep it away from them. So I believe those kinds of things, and I believe you can go through here and
sort of ask those kinds of questions. That's what we really intend to look at, is how folks on the North Slope run their affairs and what is civil industry practice.
I can assure you, if I was running that financial shop and it was vague here, I'd be hesitant to add back that insurance cost until you brought it to my attention.
Representative Falker through the chair, and I believe they try to make sure that those kind of things come to their attention.
Did you, simple point on this one.
Okay. Moving on to page 26. And there's two items here that I'd like to draw your attention to. The first is lines 3 through 5. And this subsection is about the department writing regulations. The new language is the part that's the last half, roughly, of line 2 and then on. This was Senate language, which allows the department to incorporate the concepts of Internal Revenue Code Section 482, which I talked about earlier, and that's where this is contained here. The next item on that page that I'd like to draw your attention to are lines 15 through, actually goes on to the next page. It's all of Section 4355-170. And 170 contains what is now a base allowance credit. It is the credit that was in the House Resources CS of $12 million. It has been modified here on line 20. You see that it does not exceed one half of the amount of expenditure, and that is the so-called gold plating fix that we talked about earlier. It's contained on that line.
Mr. Chairman.
Parker.
Would I just point, this was also the issue we identified this morning, that the way this is currently functioning, it does not seem to benefit the small producers it was intended to. In fact, I think it's working backwards. I just wanted to put that back out there, that we need to address that. And with apologies, sir, we went past one point before we got to that section I wanted to address.
Sure.
Thank you, sir. Page 26, line 9, the definition of ordinary and necessary. Just again, the debate we had at length here previously before this committee. Here we have ordinary and necessary in quotes with a defined term of art meaning, of course. But we go back to the very first paragraph of Section 160. Let's see. Nope, I apologize to you. It is page 21. It is subpara C of Section 160. We have changed the punctuation to direct comma, ordinary comma, and necessary, which I quite frankly read syntactically as a different statement than ordinary and necessary as defined in the later section. Clearly our intent in C is to make sure these costs are both direct as defined and ordinary and necessary. And we had the lengthy conversation with Mr. Williams on this one before the committee earlier, and I'd just like to resubmit it for consideration.
Okay.
I just want to weigh in with Representative Hawker on the concern on how the credits are impacting the explorer non-producer crowd, and how they're not getting into the Production Act. They're still back at the they're going to have some trouble taking advantage of these credits, and so I'd just like to get a chance to address that and have an impact. On the smaller ones.
Representative Kelly, we'd glad to either work with other ideas with you on this, suggest something, or look at some of the earlier versions in both the House and Senate committees that don't have that particular.
Thank you.
Okay, one last thing on Section 170 there. It also contains the rolling sunset, and you find that language at top of page 27, lines 3 through 6. And so what that language included there means is that if a person is producing now, then they can take this credit for 10 years rolling for, or 10 years. If a person is not producing in commercial quantities at this time but will begin commercial production in 2 or 3 years, but their 10 years starts then. And so the number that is on line 6, the 120 million, is simply 10 years times the 12 million. So that's what it is over the entire life of the credit. Moving on then to page 29. Line 5 is where you will find the surcharge change to 4 cents that is increasing the collected amount from 3 cents a barrel to 4. And then on to page 30, we've got some...
Representative Petula.
You even know my little, just barely opening my mouth.
bad sign. I'm sorry, when we were reading it last night, I just wasn't sure about what happens with the NGLs. Is that when we're talking about the mechanical separation of the fluids? I mean, is that within that scope, or are they separate, or I just didn't understand.
I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Petula. Are you speaking about the definition?
Right.
Okay. Rob, would you like to talk about the definitions that have been changed or added?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Petula, I don't think that there's been a change with respect to the treatment of NGLs since earlier versions of the bill. Currently, well, first of all, NGLs, that term usually applies to liquid hydrocarbons that are extracted from gas at a gas processing plant, usually through use of refrigeration. Under current law, NGLs are considered gas because the gas is produced before it gets to the gas processing plant. So even though NGLs are liquid, they're treated as gas. One of the effects of the changes in the definitions in the current bill is that NGLs would be extracted upstream of the point of production, and they'd be considered oil. So they would be basically anything that's liquid when it's produced will be oil. Anything that's gaseous when it's produced will be gas.
So they're taxed as oil. Then they're treated as oil under the bill, not as gas.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so on line 30, the definition gross value at the point of production, that is definition number 7 on lines 1 through 5 that has been added. Cooking sedimentary basin, I believe that's defined in Senate version, but it's been moved back to the general definition section here. That's number 17.
Can I ask a question on that? Sorry, and I should know this, but so those are regulations that have already been implemented, so we've got a definition currently. Thanks. Thank you.
And as Mr. Mills indicated earlier, there's been a definition added for gross or gas processing plant that is definition number 20 on lines 25 through 29. Moving over then to page 31. Again, Mr. Mills talked about dehydration and its use within the definition of gas treatment. So on page 31, lines 5 through 9 makes it clear that gas treatment does not include dehydration. And I'd like to draw your attention to lines 10 through 16. This is a new definition, and I am bringing it to your attention at this point because this is really the crux of it here. And I'll invite Mr. Mintz to jump in. But private royalty production has a different tax rate under this bill, and there was a question brought up about certain surface owners that receive royalties and how they're treated for purposes of this bill. And Mr. Mintz, would you like to expand on that a little bit?
Okay, well, generally, a royalty is a share of production from an oil and gas lease free of the cost of production. And there are generally two types of royalties. One is the royalty that's retained by the owner of the land, the lessor. And, of course, in Alaska, that's usually the state, but sometimes there's some private land. And then there's what's called overriding royalties, which is a share that the producer, the lessee, carves out of that interest and gives or usually sells to someone else. That overriding royalty interest is subject to the same tax as the rest of the production, but the bill provides a special and typically lower tax rate for the royalty that's owned by the landowner, the lessor, and that's under an oil and gas lease. But as Robin explained, there are a few situations where there's a royalty that's being offered to a surface owner in basically in exchange for use of the surface for oil and gas operations. And the committee was asked to basically extend the same treatment to that kind of royalty as is extended to lessor or landowner royalties under an oil and gas lease. So this definition just expands the category of royalties to include that rather unusual situation where there's a royalty associated with a surface use agreement.
Senator Jewell, do you have a question? Did you have a follow-up, Representative Jewell?
Yeah, thank you. And just for reference now, the definition is there on page 31, and then the private royalty rates are found on page at the bottom of page 3, and that is section 011F. So that's where it starts, and so you'll see that the term landowner's royalty interest has been used now rather than private royalty. Okay, then moving on in the definitions, there is now, I'm back on page 31, definition number 24, that is lines 19 on down and goes on to the page 32. Point of production, the definition has been added. And again, it's not changing the intent, but it was noticed that there was no definition for point of production. The rest are the transition details, conforming changes to the changes discussed before. The one addition I guess I would like to draw your attention to very quickly is on page 34. The bill, as it's gone through the various committees and various forms, is provided for a transition period of 6 months paying under the old rules with 7 months true-up, but that just with referencing whatnot, it did not include the oil spill surcharges. So lines 12 through 23 address the payment of the surcharges, and lines 24 on to the next page address the filing. And what it says is that they will be handled the same way as the rest of the TPP provisions, that is 6 months transition and the 7 months true-up. You can see throughout, and then on page 36, last line, line 5, contains the effective date first. I do have a handful of slides here on tax effects. If I could just give it a few.
The
So the first slide shows a cumulative severance tax for the 24-year period from 2007 to 2030. It shows by the price of oil. And what we see here, the status quo, which is in dark blue, obviously is the lowest line. The governor's bill is the sort of magenta line, and the Senate bill, House Research CS, and House Finance CS lie pretty close together there. At high oil prices, the House Resources CS is just slightly above there. I would just note that these were put together last evening pretty quickly. They are preliminary numbers, but we anticipate that they're pretty close.
Just in going through the various models and things last night, someone mentioned to me that there's always this $8.32 a barrel is the fixed lease expenditure deduction. And I just wondered how that got, you know, how you came to that and if that's a realistic figure, and or am I wrong?
Representative Curtula, through the chair, I think, if I believe what you're referring to is a slide that Roger Marks presented that showed the average. In fact, it's not just an 833 applied, I believe, and I can look it up, but my recollection is there are, I believe, five different categories of costs. In other words, and depending on the profile that you put out in the future, those will differ. But, you know, I think there's a what we've tried to do is build a model. As you know, there are four models. I believe this is low volume scenario.
Yes.
And what we do is, and then you know, when you're seeing five lines, they're consistently applied. And the notion is, you know, when heavy oil is in there, it'll have a much higher cost, a much lower value. When light oil is in there, it'll be reversed. So all those pieces are assumptions that we make and then try to hold constant over the modeling. I think the 833 was simply an average cost, an average capital expenditure per barrel. But I believe in his first presentation, Roger Marks presented sort of showed the capital spending profile that was behind the model.
So you probably can't tell me what you did use, or you just how are you coming to that figure?
Representative Petula, for the chair, if you give me 1 minute, I can't.
Thanks.
I'll try to. If you want to go into the next questions, it might take me a minute to find the slide.
Okay, we'll come back if we need to there. Okay, moving on then. We've got three slides that show annual severance tax at various price levels from 2003 or 2007 through 2030. And the little sort of bump in the road there at roughly 2016, 2017 is a result of the sunset, the transition sunset. And then at $60 oil, the effect isn't quite so pronounced of the sunset. And at $70 oil, you can see that in 2010, you're looking at collections of just under $3.5 billion. And tapering off is oil production. A little bit of wave is the various fields coming on periodically, small fields. And I wanted to spend a moment on the progressivity. The green line on top is the House Resources CS, and it takes the jump up that we're all familiar with.
Seton's wall.
So that's clearly the highest.
The slope on that was 0.003, and then it jumps up at 110. The lowest line is the Senate finance proposal that was on net. That was the first one we saw that was on net. That was at the lowest slope. It was 0.001, and it started at a trigger point of $45 per barrel net. Okay. The turquoise line is the Senate progressivity, which was on gross. And then the two lines I wanted to draw your attention to, the blue one is the House, is the bill before you, with a slope of 0.25% or 0.0025, and it is triggered at $35 per barrel net. So the trigger is earlier. I believe the committee has asked for some various scenarios previously. There was some interest in one of these lines that was shown that had a slope of 0.0025 but started later. So what we see is then at $130 per barrel of oil, you've got a per barrel progressivity of about, looks like about $24.50 per barrel. The reason, if one was to say what was the same crossover point, and by that I mean in this context, at $130 per oil, that other chart showed $20 per barrel progressivity. Because we are taking the same slope and moving it to a lower trigger point, then that caused the difference between the blue line, which is the bill in front of you, and sort of the as-if yellow line. The reason that the green line is higher, even though it is deductible, it's got a higher slope. So if you take into account the higher slope plus the deductibility, and then factor in the fact that's on gross, whereas the bill before you is on net, that accounts for why the green line is just slightly higher than the blue line. So, you know, one might say, well, the green line is at 0.003, and if you take 80% of that because it's deductible, you come out with 0.024. So why is that not below the blue line, which is at 0.025? The reason is because you're applying it against gross in the case of the green line, which is higher than net in the case of the blue line. Okay, I think that's the charts. Do you have further information on the cost?
I don't know if that was distributed to folks, and I can certainly walk through that chart. Or
would you like a copy of it?
That'll help. that was the strain of my system. Thank you.
For the record, Representative Ellsberg has joined us. Representative Gittenberg is in here, and whom am I missing? Well, Representative Berkowitz was here for a little while. Go ahead, Dave.
Representative Chenault, I believe that this was a presentation on February 23rd, so I believe it was probably made in the resources, in the House Resources Committee. And basically, this simply sets out some of the parameters in the modeling. $100 million a year in exploration expenditures for the next 25 years. Every barrel that was produced had a dollar associated with sort of capital cost as it was produced. On conventional oil, or on two-thirds of the conventional oil, there was a $3.50 barrel developmental capital, and I believe that's sort of lagged in front of the time the barrel is produced. On heavy oil, on known heavy oil, that's an $8 a barrel developmental capital. Then there is a $3.50 developmental capital on new conventional oil. I believe that's lagged a different way, $8 development cost on new heavy oil as well. Again, we don't know when it's going to be, so it's probably just out there as a sort of a continuous dollar per barrel. On operating costs, we were using $3 for conventional oil, $5 for heavy oil, and again, that would be in the month or the year that it was being produced. One other important point, especially on the slides that you've seen here, is that for that portion of heavy oil, the value is also being discounted. So we say $70 oil, in this case it would be something more like $56 being received for the heavy oil. And then the final one in costs and prices are in real dollars. As time goes on, if there's an inflator, we're simply accounting, presenting it in money of the day. But these numbers would be the real dollar effect of those. So I believe if you sat down and calculated a value, on a recent barrel or something, you'd have some combination of $3.50 and $1 and some fraction of expiration costs, and maybe the mix between heavy and light oil, and you might come up with that $8.33 figure, but that's just a guess.
Thank you.
Okay. That is. Thank you for overview. I've got some questions about the nickel barrel. Yes, Elise Larry Dietrich.
Chair. On the overview, diverting back to that, I've got two questions I'd like to ask on the overview.
Okay. Before we get to Larry, then let's go back to questions on overview, then we'll go to Larry.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. One section that is not in the bill before us that we've seen in previous iterations is some mechanism for the state to buy back credits from producers, or from large, basically it would be from explorers or extremely small producers who are investing more money than they can recover the credits generated against their production. As we said, well, we made the credits transferable so that they could be factored and bought up by somebody else, but ultimately with the state being on the hook for the whole dollar, somebody's going to use that. The House Resources version had a $10 million buyback, which essentially put all the money back in the hands of the people we intended to benefit, which would be the small producer. If any thoughts, I'm looking at proposing putting that back into the bill, and I'm going to be honest with you, the $10 million seemed rather miserly to me, if considering the scope and costs of operating in an oil field, and I'm wondering if putting it back into the $25 to $35 million level, what the administration's response would be.
The risk, of course, is if in falling oil prices, that the state would be sort of on the hook, not just for falling PPT revenues, but then actually to refund tax credits. The risk at $10 million refund level is quite a bit less than if it was raised significantly. So I would say the risk goes up, probably proportionate to the amount of potential refunds that are out there. You're welcome to add to that.
Representative Holger, through the chair, I think that's exactly right. For example, let's say when we were using 8 full effective users of this, so that would be $80 million. And if you went to 25, you would raise that to, if I can do the math in my head, $200 million. And I believe generally the notion was, I believe as the House Resources version read, every single producer could come and ask for that credit. And so if you had the situation where, I believe he spoke about this morning that Representative Fertula brought up, where there was heavy investment and then a price correction, so the state has maybe $100 million in PPT revenues, those are quickly eaten up by credits, then you would either then go below that by $100 million or $200 million, depending on what the level was set. I can only tell you what I observed. In the Senate, not only was that taken out, but at one point amendments were introduced to allow these credits to be used against income tax, which essentially is another way of saying what happens to a small producer. And just to remind folks who may not be aware of a feature of our state's income tax,
because it runs on factors, you can come here, you can have a bunch of people here and a bunch of equipment because you're drilling holes in the ground, you haven't produced a penny of revenue yet, and yet you owe income tax because you have business activity in the state. We look at your worldwide activity and we take the Alaska fractional portion of it sort of more synergistically than the fact that you have any revenue at the moment. So amendment was brought forward to then say, gee, instead of purchasing it back, why don't we let them take it against some other cash flows? Again, I can't speak to the folks who voted it down. The Senate did vote it down, and I believe the rationale was exactly as I think Representative Petula expressed this morning, that puts a lot of pressure on the remaining state revenues if that's allowed.
Fully respecting the scenario you've described, but have you not described the perfect storm of risk where you skewed your response all the way to the left-hand bar of the chart where the state is receiving essentially such a small amount, or the state would be entitled to such amount of production tax that the big eight players that are involved here, not one of them would be utilizing are able to utilize their credits. And if I recall the charts that we've been looking at, I mean, you've got to get down to a mighty small oil price before we kind of go to zero on realizing a production tax, even under all these scenarios.
Representative Hawker, through the chair, I believe that again, depending on which you're looking at the modeling, it is a price which is substantially higher than we experienced throughout the 80s and the early 90s. At that time, when we had prices in the $17, $18 range, we were producing 2 million barrels of oil. We're now producing 850,000 barrels of oil. And out several years, we'll probably be producing less than that. So, the fact that in 1999, for example, when prices were in the $12 range, the state still produced the revenues were hundreds of millions of dollars of revenues. Under the PPT, there would not be. So your sense of it's an extreme, far-out case that Representative Petula described, I wouldn't characterize it that way. We can see the kind of prices we've seen historically, and it would meet your definition of a perfect storm, particularly if there had been investments. It followed a period of high prices with investments, and you had a price crash, and the astonishing speed of those crashes, such as we had in 86, that's probably the most dramatic one. I wouldn't view that as merely a sort of a bad story to scare this away. I think it's a likelihood that you should consider very real.
Question two. Issue of these organizations that operate in multi-state and particularly multi-state environments here in Alaska, if I recall correctly, we would be the first state to adopt a net profits-based production tax within the United States as states go. Certainly it's a well-established mechanism worldwide, but it's be a new animal for a state jurisdiction in the U.S. will apply. What comes at issue here is that question of other states interpreting our net profits production tax as a tax on income and earnings rather than on production. And I think I've heard you debate in other committees somewhere with apologies, I don't remember where, but I've heard you be resistive to putting in a statement at the very front of this as we're prefacing the bill and says, this is a production tax, this is not an income tax. I was wondering, what's your resistance to that one?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, I hope I haven't been, well, what I have resisted is making an assertion that this is not a tax which measures net income. My point is, and I believe maybe Robin is more appropriate person, if folks are interested in figuring out what this tax is, whether it meets their definitions, they'll probably do more than look at the title page or the name of it or a line that says we intended to deal with that. So I believe that this is a production tax. It is not an income tax. We already have an income tax. There are many elements that are different. That having been said, what we have done in measuring the production value is we have gone and introduced some elements which appear to be closer to income elements. And I think each state will come and make their judgments. But I certainly view it as a production tax. and you know, all we're doing is measuring the value of that production in a way that recognizes our greatest problem, which is lack of investment. And I guess all I have resisted is saying a single line that says this is X or this is Y or it is Z, when it is what it is, and our calling it something won't change that.
If I could, and Robin, does the department concur with that? And it just seems to me to be such a simple thing to do, to provide the step for an argument with someone else's department or revenue. I mean, you've probably been in the same world. I've fought multi-state tax apportionment battles, and you want, and in our case, I don't believe we're trying to compromise our industry in this case.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, if I might add Mr. Hudson's answer. Just for the folks at home to get a little context, for the state income tax, and this is true, I think, for every other state that uses an apportionment method, quite often, and certainly we do, we start with federal taxable income and then add back income taxes to get sort of an equal playing field for all the states, and that's what's apportioned. Now, that's a pretty simple exercise for domestic companies. An income tax in a state is pretty easy to identify. Because we're on a worldwide basis, then we're looking at income and deductions for companies all over the world, affiliated companies. And it is not nearly as easy to tell if you're dealing with, say, a Mideastern country as to what that government take thing is. It could be labeled a royalty. It could be labeled a severance tax. Maybe it's labeled as an income tax. But we really have to get in and analyze how it functions. We have a Supreme Court case, the Gulf case, which says you look to the essence of the tax and how it behaves, and are there deductions? You start with sort of gross revenue and have deductions, and I don't care what it's called. That makes it an income tax, and so it will be added back. And certainly, particularly in the Mideastern countries, we can get into some long discussions with taxpayers about whether this is an income tax. And so, quite often, what we hear is, oh, this is a production tax. But as we get into the meat of it, it's labeled a production tax, but as we get into the meat of it, our conclusion may be that it is, in fact, an income tax and is so added back. It is my feeling if this PPT is, if there's a piece in there that says this is not an income tax, it seems a reasonable question from a taxpayer that says, well, gee, if this is not an income tax, it seems like, the tax in X country behaves kind of the same way, and how can you call it an income tax? So I think that, we have taken some historic positions on certain countries' taxes or government take or however they're labeled, and to say that this is not an income tax, may threaten that position. And I would expect other states to look to the crux of the bill and not what it's labeled as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm not quite as convinced as you are on this one. That I just don't see you compromising your position to simply provide a hook for the folks that we're asking to step up to the plate with another $2 billion a year for us. So,
again, if I might add to my answer, we did see some language that proposed perhaps changing to a title severance tax rather than production tax, and Mr. Mintz can certainly jump in here. That seems like it would be preferable to saying this is not an income tax. If you would like to add to that further.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hawker, I'm not sure what the motivation is for changing the name from production tax to severance tax, or whether that would do anything along the lines that may be hoped for from what you're talking about. But I would certainly reinforce Robin's concern that by making a statement, a characterization, which I think is really gratuitous and is not necessary for implementing our tax system, we would be potentially giving ammunition to income taxpayers to use against us.
Thank you, sir.
Any questions? No, sir. Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the perfect storm exchange and prices taking a dive, first of all, I hope we've captured some of this so I can just push button number 7, and it's Dan on when the price goes low and why you need a floor. I probably wouldn't have to say a word, but on the whole issue of the perfect storm and the 200 million credits in the exchange with Representative Hawker, if we just made that available to the explorers and small producers, wouldn't that solve that problem or substantially mitigate it? We've talked about whether to make that available for everybody or not. It's kind of been my theory. If you're handing out bags of marbles in here, you can bet the little guys will be out in the lot playing with them later on, and the big guys will throw them in the back of the truck, and you won't get the desired result if marble playing was what you were after. So I think that we've got to hit that head on, and I know the big guys don't like it, but is that the way to solve that problem?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, certainly to the extent that you limit potential tax refunds, that would limit risk from the administration and government standpoint. And it could be done based on levels of production.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions?
Representative
White Rock has joined us. Robin, thank you. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, we will move to Nickel Barrel. Larry, are you handy? Representative Petula, did you want to pose your question to Mr. Deeper?
Yeah, what I wanted to know was your opinion about what the right split would be. I mean, we've been down so far this year under the current scenario that we had to go take the commercial cruise ship fund and put it into the 470 fund, and it was up to a nickel a barrel. Now it's being proposed in this CS to come back down to 4 cents. So I'd like your opinion about, you know, what's really going to be necessary for the future so that we don't go raiding other funds. And second, the opinion about the catastrophic and whether it should be limited to that with what I'm thinking is a pretty high amount of oil being spilled. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Larry Dietrich. I'm with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, Division of Spill Prevention and Response. I think maybe if I cover on the surcharge question, I can tell you how they came to be where they're at in this spreadsheet that was passed out today. First of all, there's two accounts involved on the spreadsheet today, and there's two surcharge accounts, and they're both based on crude oil production, not on the price per barrel. The first account is commonly referred to as the response account, and the current surcharge for the response account is 2 cents per barrel. The response account is a $50 million cash reserve that is used for response to catastrophic spills, very large incidents that the state may encounter. The 2 cent surcharge that fuels that account is comes on only when the balance in that account drops below $50 million. That account was created in 1995. There was a deposit made into that account when it was created. The 2 cent tax kicked in after that account was created. It ran for about 3 months. The balance went up over $50 million. The 2 cent surcharge shut off at that time and hasn't been on since. So that's the response account part. The second account surcharge account is referred to as a prevention account, and that's used to as a revenue source for the state's operating costs for the spill prevention and response programs. So that 3 cent surcharge is also based then on crude oil production and funds the annual operating costs. Since the surcharges were originally created, the crude oil production has dropped from about, gone from about 1.65 million barrels per day to approximately 850,000 barrels per day. So the reduction in flow has created a significant revenue stream for the prevention account, which is the revenue source then for the state's spill prevention response programs. In our budget this year, in the administration's budget request for FY07, we propose to fill then the fiscal gap this year as a result of that shortage with general fund revenues. The Senate did not want to use a general fund. They wanted us to explore a long-term non-general fund fix. And so they requested some scenarios and projections from our Division of Administrative Services at changing the current revenue from 0.03 to 0.04, and then a second projection to 0.05 to see how that would level our revenues out into the future. Our Division of Administrative Services prepared those projections and provided them to the Senate, and the Senate proposal is to restore the surcharge to the 5 cent level as their proposal for a long-term solution to avoid us coming back for general fund monies in the future. And they also included language then that would to keep expenditures within that amount. So that, Mr. Chairman, is our understanding of the how the 0.05 option evolved here this year.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know how far you want to go into this. It's really not.
Well, I don't think we need to go real deep into it. I think you have the subcommittee on that. Yeah. So.
I do, and I think what we found is that most of the oil spills that you're spending a lot of your time and money on don't even pertain to the oil industry. And I think the conversation and the thought that we had was that maybe we should start charging back those who are causing the oil spills, whether it be the state of Alaska ourselves, or one of the worst culprits, Alaska Railroad and DOT and some of the fishing vessels. But it's my understanding they don't pay anything into this fund. So my thought was, rather than collecting more on a per barrel basis, you know, maybe start looking at some of these other industries also contributing to the pot, and then I think the issue goes away. And also too, having this in my subcommittee, it was my understanding, since that 2 cents that goes to the 50 million, and the 50 million pot you said was full, so there is no more money going there. So if we simply switched that and now had 4 cents going over to the operations side, that was going to suffice your needs at least for the next couple of years. Is that correct, or am I?
Yes, Representative Myers, through the chair, that's correct. The House proposal is set at 4 cents. There were discussions about alternative funding sources. I believe our Division of Administration at the 4% did some projections, and they felt that we would have to come back in within 1 to 2 years to supplement that at the 4% surcharge level.
Okay, and then if I can follow up, then is are my facts correct on as far as who creates most of your expenses and most of your time and effort? Is it safe to say it's not the oil industry alone that's creating the bulk of your expense?
Representative, through the chair, yes. The total number of spill reports we receive annually is about 2,000 on average. That's kind of a long-term average. The actual breakdown, we can break those down between crude oil and refined oil, and then by source. And yes, there's. I don't have those figures with me right now, but there's spills that come from the refined products industry, from vessels, the transportation sector. They come fishing vessels from all areas of the state. I don't have those exact numbers at the top of my head right now. But
That's as far as I can go.
Representative Stoltz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was kind of confused, and I stepped in a little late after being distracted, but I assume you're just here to talk about what your budgetary needs are. You're not recommending tax policy from DEC, are you? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's I'm kind of...
I asked for the information because there's been a clear list of players here,
and I hadn't seen DEC at this stable. And if you're so, you're far underpaid, I guess.
There was a concern about the five versus the six. So that's
okay. Just the mechanics, Mr. Chairman.
That's correct.
Okay, I just wanted to make that clear. What we were trying to find out.
Okay. All right, Larry. Thank you.
The issue on the catastrophic spill. If we limit it to the catastrophic spill, and I mean the barrels being such a high number, if we happen, you know, on the. Are your spills normally of the catastrophic nature? I mean, you have spills that are extremely important. I mean, problematic, but they don't amount to that range. Is that right? I mean, the BP spill recently, that didn't amount to being in that range even, did it?
Yes, Representative Tula. Yeah, the catastrophic level that Rob referred to is at the 100,000 barrel level, so that's 4.2 million gallons. So that's a very, very large event, and it's fair to say we've only had one of those in this state, and that all of the other ones have been below that level.
Any rough ballpark about what this last spill on the North Slope cost to clean up?
Through the chair, Representative Petrula, the actual costs of the cleanup are borne by the spiller. The state federal law are the same in that the spiller pays. So those are not costs that are revealed to us, and I would have to defer to Department of Revenue as to how those are handled. We simply don't get involved with that.
Do you know the state side of it at all?
Representative Petrula, through the chair, yeah, the state costs probably estimated to date are probably $150,000 to $200,000 for the oversight costs.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
Okay. If there's no other questions, Representative Katula, do you still object to adopting the House CS?
Yes, but I'll withdraw.
Any other objections?
Yeah.
Hearing none, the House Finance CS is adopted.
Working document.
As a working document before the committee. Now, before I go to an at ease, I would like to see what amendments that are out there, if you have them available.
I don't have them.
I know you may
right
not
now,
have
yeah.
all of your amendments available, but if you have amendments out there, we would like to probably come back at, when is it, 3:15 now?
3:10.
10 after 3. And if there are amendments available, we'd like to go ahead and start working on those amendments and try to get those moved. And we'll continue working as long as we have amendments in front of us.
When are we coming back? I'm sorry.
We have a conference committee at 4 o'clock, so I would say 5. We can work from 5 till 6 if people get here, and we can take care of some amendments that are out there that we already know are needed, and we can continue up until we go to the floor. Okay. President Kelly, excuse me.
We're going to have Econ 1, Daniel Johnson. We're going to have some folks available.
I think Econ 1 is online. Are they still online? We would have to call them.
I mean, are they
but we may try to do that. If you have questions.
I guess, are they going to be around camp here, or are they going to be?
Econ 1, we can call. Last thing that I got from Mr. Johnston is that he is in Dundee, Scotland until the 13th of this month. We may be able to try to contact him and get him to call in, but it's probably a little late for Mr. Johnston. Like I say, if there's questions or concerns, we can probably get a contact number with him, and you'd be able to contact him. But we're going to move forward, and at a pace that we can handle, and that that we can get our work done and get the amendments drafted. So I realize there's some concerns about maybe not having one or the other economist group that we have working on this project, but I don't control those guys. Representative Kelly.
Yeah, here's my challenge there is, you know, whether it's the GRE or the going from two-thirds to one-third or covering all three of the areas or trying to put a pin in and just cover them all with one number or exclude cooking. I mean, we've got some little bit of work to do on some of the questions, particularly on that gas. And I'm just wondering what our, as just a committee member, what our, how we're going to tackle that. So I'll talk to you after we
do. Okay. That's not a problem. So if there's no other questions, I'll call the meeting at ease. We will try to be back about 5 o'clock and start looking at amendments. If you have them, I would like to see them so that we can move the process forward. With that, thank you, and we're at ease. Well, we got 6 o'clock floor, so I know it's good.
I think it's nice for me.